Today on Study Grow Know, we delve even further into the exploits of the infamous Antiochus Epiphanes IV as we continue in our study of Daniel chapter 11. I'm Dr. Fred. Thanks for listening to Study Grow Know.
Welcome to Study, Grow, Know, where we discuss theology, prophecy, and current political issues from a conservative biblical perspective. Here's your host, Dr. Fred DeRuvo.
Thank you so much for joining me again. This is Dr. Fred. You're listening to Study, Grow, Know. And as I mentioned, we are in the process of dealing with a series we're calling Prophecies of Daniel, Chapter 11. And this is basically Part 10. So if you've missed any preceding installments of this particular series, I would encourage you to go back and find number one and start there and bring you all the way up to date through this current one that we're talking about today. Now, in our previous article, which was, of course, part 9, we discussed more about the man history reveals as Antiochus Epiphanes IV. The Bible calls him in Daniel 11:21 a despicable individual. We noted a few of his devious exploits as outlined in the 11th chapter of Daniel, which is, of course, what we're dealing with. And we also pointed out and referred to 1 Maccabees chapter 3, specifically verse 30, to verify the record of Antiochus Epiphanes. Now, in this particular installment, we're going to find out more about this same guy and why the Bible refers to him as a detestable or despicable person. Remember, when the angelic messenger first revealed all of this information to Daniel, it was long before any of this that we're discussing now took place. The terminology is naturally, from Daniel's perspective, future tense. Now, of course, from our perspective, most of this, especially dealing with Antiochus Epiphanes IV, and those who came before him, that's all in our past. But there are still things in chapter 11 which are yet future. They have not occurred yet, so we'll get to those shortly. But note again how God stoops to prove his omniscience as well as his benevolence toward us. He also is indicating, verifying his sovereignty. Now, he didn't have to share any of Daniel 11. In fact, he didn't have to share anything about prophetic insight regarding many of the things that were to happen in history. But he chose to do so in order that we might have a better understanding of how God controls all things, especially as they relate to the only nation he personally created, Israel. Daniel 11, while showing us the past, which is, of course, as I said, the future from Daniel's perspective, also shows us the future from our perspective, because the latter portion of Daniel 11 relates to Israel as this current age comes to a close. Now, it's important to understand this and refrain from what many people do today. They allegorize Scripture so that what is applied to Israel is then wrongly applied to the church. We need to not do that. We need to refrain from doing that. There's no good reason to do that. Certainly the text gives us no indication that what the angelic messenger is discussing is to be allegorized. There is a literal meaning in everything that the angelic messenger is telling Daniel and ultimately us. And we also previously noted that Ptolemy the Sixth and Antiochus Epiphanes IV sat at Ptolemy's dinner table and essentially exchanged lies with one another. Unbeknownst to Ptolemy, though, Antiochus had already bought favors from many of the individuals who also sat at the table and were outwardly, but only outwardly, on Ptolemy's side. In other words, he bought all these people. It still happens today, as we know. Bribes, graft, corporate greed, it's all there, and especially so in politics. Now, in reality, as Daniel 11:26 through 27 tells us, those who sat around Ptolemy's table had already committed treason, which would ultimately bring about Ptolemy's defeat. The dinner we learned about in verses 26 through 27 was more of an attempted peace conference. It wasn't a physical battle, necessarily. It was a battle of wit in words. Superficially, though, things seemed good. So let's pick it up with Daniel 11:28. Quote, "Then he will return to his land with much plunder, but his heart will be set against the Holy Covenant, and he will take action and then return to his own land, unquote. All right, that's one verse. The he, of course, in this passage is referring to Antiochus as the one who leaves Egypt, the king of the south, with plunder and returns to his own land, which is Syria, since he is the then current king of the north. As he passes through Israel on his way back to Syria, he decides to veer off the path and heads up to Israel. Now, Antiochus, interestingly enough, was always looking for the next thing to provide an advantage. And as he traveled toward Jerusalem, Dr. Constable tells us that a Jew named Jason wanted to be the high priest. The problem was that Onias III was already high priest. Jason, who knew of Antiochus's reputation, simply offered him a bribe to get rid of Onias. Antiochus was in. But, like everything in life when it comes to politics, bribery, backstabbing, and intrigue, another Jew by the name of Menelaus also stood in line with an even better bribe for Antiochus, who also accepted that bribe to overlook Jason. This is getting intriguing, isn't it? I mean, it's like a soap opera. So Onias, the then current high priest, objected to Jason becoming high priest, and for that he lost his life. This is part of the picture that is painted for us in verse 28. The text refers to the Holy Covenant. Because of its use of the word holy, it likely refers not to Ptolemy and his supposed covenant with Antiochus, but to Israel and or Jerusalem, specifically to the high priest who guards that covenant between Israel as a nation and the God of Israel. This is also referenced in Daniel 11:22, where we are told that the prince of the covenant will be shattered. You can go back and check that from Daniel 11:22. That's where Onias dies, and secular history bears this out. Now, Antiochus was so easily bought and liked to protect those whom he received tribute from that in this case, he wound up initially protecting both Jason and Menelaus, but took things out on the people of Jerusalem after Onias' death. And after Jason attempted a coup d'etat, thinking that Antiochus was dead, Antiochus entered Jerusalem, slew 80,000 men, and accompanied by Menelaus, desecrated the temple. And that happened in 168 BC. And again, secular history verifies this. Now let's look at Daniel 11:29 through 30, which says this, quote, "At the appointed time, he will return and come into the south. But this last time, it will not turn out the way it did before, for ships of Kittim will come against him. Therefore, he will be disheartened and will return and become enraged at the Holy Covenant and take action. So he will come back and show regard for those who forsake the Holy Covenant." Unquote. That again is Daniel 11:29 through 30. Now, the above text begins with "at the appointed time," referencing again that God is in control of man's deeds, especially deeds related to Israel and or Jerusalem. Nothing is left to chance, even when evil men are allowed to exercise their so-called free will in warring against God's people. Now, in the above two verses that I just read, we learn that he, Antiochus, will again return to the south, Egypt, but unlike the previous situation where Antiochus left with a good deal of plunder, this time he will leave with his tail between his legs. And as history attests, Antiochus marched with his troops to Egypt, but he was met by Roman Pompilius Lanus near Alexandria. Lanus was not going to allow Antiochus to invade Egypt and even had a letter from the Roman Senate forbidding such a move on Antiochus's part. Dr. Constable notes that the ships of Kittim were from Cyprus and belonged to Lanus and Rome. Antiochus basically had two options: attempt to fight Rome, which would likely cost him his life, or return home to Syria in defeat. Well, he chose the latter. Please notice the text said he would become enraged at the Holy Covenant and take action. Antiochus was defeated without Rome even firing a shot or throwing a spear. He was humiliated as he now heads for home. Once again, he remembers Jerusalem, where not long before this humiliation, he had killed 80,000 men and desecrated the temple. Maybe another go at it would remove his feelings of low self-esteem. What do you think? Well, Antiochus counted on the support of those Jews who had long ago abandoned the Mosaic Law, the Holy Covenant, and was disappointed. You know, interestingly enough, when people allow themselves to become corrupted, nothing can usually change that. So Antiochus counted on the support, as I mentioned, of the Jews who had long ago abandoned the Mosaic Law, the Holy Covenant, and he wasn't disappointed. He was corrupt. Some of the people in Israel, Jerusalem, were corrupt, and money further corrupts. Political favors corrupt. Is it any wonder that no empire in history lasts that long before it begins to fail? Human greed tends to corrupt a system from within. And that, my friends, is what's happening with America today. And that failure will culminate ultimately in a complete collapse. I have no idea what that looks like. I don't know how that's going to affect everything. It could wind up just simply being a smooth transition into a new world order. We don't really know. But America, as we know it, will collapse. This next portion is connected to Daniel 11:31, and we'll simply introduce it now and go into far greater detail in our next installment. Quote, "Forces from him will arise, desecrate the sanctuary fortress, and do away with the regular sacrifice, and they will set up the abomination of desolation." Now, historians note that Antiochus desecrated the temple by waltzing into the Holy of Holies after offering a pig on the altar. He took that pig's blood, sprinkled it around the Holy of Holies, and some even tell us that he set up a statue of Zeus in the Holy of Holies and may have even put a mask of his own face over the face of Zeus. Zeus was Antiochus's patron god, his patron deity. Now, this event is what became known as the abomination that desolates, or the abomination of desolation that Jesus refers to in his Olivet Discourse, Matthew 24, Mark 13, Luke 21. And Paul refers to this as he looks ahead to the time when the final man of lawlessness will find his way onto the world stage, and he does so in 2 Thessalonians 2. Every male Jew living during the time of Jesus would have recognized the phrase abomination of desolation as referring back to the imperious act by Antiochus Epiphanes IV in 168 BC. Now, we're going to dig into the above verse in our next article, which is part 11, our next installment. So, because there's a good amount of material we need to highlight, so please join me then. But I also want to remind you folks that you can also follow my blog, studygrowknowblog.com, and it's got all these articles written there with some graphics, etc., and links to other things. So you might get more out of that if you prefer reading it than you do listening. But in either case, I thank you for joining me, and until we meet again, I pray that God will open your eyes to show you how blessed you are.
You've been listening to Study, Grow, Know with Dr. Fred DeRuvo. Please join us each week for new broadcasts that deal with theology, prophecy, and political issues from a biblical, conservative perspective.